So these are the comments and some of the stories that you definitely need to know about today.
Every decision I've taken has been about putting the country I love first. I will resign as leader of the Labour Party.
Donald J. Trump is the only head of state in the entire world who is sympathetic to the nation of Israel.
I have to make
now.
A point of
no,
order.
You will be quiet
because this is what the chair
now.
Should be doing.
You spoke,
I make
now
a point of order.
Shame on you.
It is Israel and the United States who commit genocide and war crimes in Gaza, in Lebanon.
Violence against Christians in the state of Israel.
Boy, there's a lot going on, a lot of commentary, all this, and we're live in Switzerland for the talks. Also, George Galloway is going to be joining us to talk about Keir Starmer. This is the Sanchez Effect. Let's do it. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. As usual, I want to thank the millions of you out there who are checking in from all over the world in five languages. We're so happy you're there. All right, here's where we are. One of the biggest backers of the war against Russia and the war against Iran has resigned. Keir Starmer, just a few hours ago, announced that he's out. Obviously, it's not his decision. He's being pushed out. He's being forced out by the party after literally some of the worst approval ratings, translation, the British people don't like him, in decades. Here's part of how he went out.
Our reputation in the world restored, with Britain once again standing up for decency, respect, and the rule of law, securing trade deals, standing with Ukraine, standing up for our values. The question my party is asking now is whether I am best placed to lead us into the next general election. Every decision I've taken has been about putting the country I love first. That is why I will resign as leader of the Labour Party.
Is any of that true? You know, like many Americans, the British people have become angry and they're starting to question why Starmer and others in their government are so hell-bent on spending their money in ways they don't want it spent, on money being sent overseas, for example, for wars they did not approve of. Starmer's resigning. But he does so while sticking the people of the UK with bills of, well, $28 billion for Ukraine, for example, another $3 billion a year indefinitely on top of that. Is that what the British people want? And by the way, is that going to change with his replacement? The best answer is only, maybe somewhat. See, corruption from bankers and weapons deals, it's baked into the British system. Baked into the Labour Party. Henceforth, the only change that may come will occur with a change in how the country is actually led, but that remains to be seen. You know who we're going to be asking about that? George Galloway. He's going to be joining us in just a little bit, right here. All right, now let's go to the other war that Starmer has stuck his own people with. Yes, I know, he's denied it. He said, I had nothing to do with this, I don't want it. Well, independent reporting, including some investigative reports, have shown the British military has been very involved in the bombing of Iran. I've seen the video myself. I shared them with you on one of the shows here about a month ago, do you remember? So yes, Iran is also involved in the Starmer case. But here's the latest on Iran. So the Strait of Hormuz is partially closed again. I know. Sounds like a broken record. So here's what's happened. Iran said, you remember, after agreeing to the peace deal, the MOU, the Memorandum of Understanding, that any attacks on Lebanon must stop. And they said that if Israel continues bombing Lebanon again, this deal with Trump would be off. President Trump told Israel, please respect the peace deal. Do not hit Lebanon. So what has Israel done? You know, here's the latest. Iran declares closure of the Strait of Hormuz over deadly Israeli strikes on Lebanon. At least 38 people killed immediately after Israel, which has long wanted to gobble up that land, began bombing several cities in Lebanon again. The IDF hit Nabatea, Tyre, Jezzine, in the Bekaa Valley and in parts of eastern Lebanon. The death toll, well, according to reports, it's somewhere around 83, but there's a real good chance it could go up more. So ask yourself, what is this? This is plain and simple, and for all the world to see, a message that is being sent by Israel, telling Iran, telling President Trump, telling the world that they, Israel, will decide when this war with Iran should end. They make the decision, right? In fact, Israeli government officials have gone even further. They're blasting President Trump and the United States. Members of the Israeli cabinet have called the president of the United States weak for this peace deal with Iran. And by the way, this has created quite a stir in the U.S. government. Look at this. Vice President J.D. Vance, he's now in Switzerland trying to negotiate with Iran, although I'm not sure that's going so well right now, shot back with a statement blasting Israel. Yeah, blasting Israel. And the statement that he's made has made headlines all over the world. And in the statement, Vance reminds Israel, he actually is telling Israel that he tells them, you're like one of the most hated countries in the entire world right now. You have one ally, and it's us, the United States. Here, listen to Vance.
My message to them would be twofold. Number one, Donald J. Trump is the only head of state in the entire world who is sympathetic to the nation of Israel at this moment in time. And he happens to be the head of state of the world superpower. If I was in the cabinet of the Israeli government, I might not be attacking the only powerful ally that I have anywhere left in the entire world. And the second message I would give to some of those cabinet members, Bibi, to his credit, has not gone down this path, but to some of these cabinet members in Israel who are attacking the President of the United States, the other thing that I would say is that over the last 3 months, 2/3 of the defensive weapons that have protected your homeland have been built by American hands and paid for by American tax dollars. The problem for Israel is not Donald J. Trump. And anybody in Israel who thinks their biggest problem is the President of the United States needs to wake up and smell the reality of the situation that country is in.
Let me tell you some reporting on that, by the way. This guy's been waiting to make that statement. He's been itching to say that because he's believed that for a long time, not just now. We are the only ally you have. That's what he just told Israel. Everybody else hates you. I mean, and we make your weapons and you still don't appreciate what we do. That's what he just said. That comment, by the way, has made even more headlines around the world, including, look at this one in Australia. I just picked it out of the bunch. J.D. Vance delivers stunning development in U.S.-Israel relations. Yeah, they're right with this headline. This is the first time that a U.S. leader, in my lifetime anyway, no less a vice president, has so forcefully criticized Israel. But it wasn't just Vice President Vance over the weekend doing this. Check out this scene. Check out this scene I found at the United Nations over the weekend. Let me share this with you.
You caved to the Secretary General's obsession with targeting Israel.
I'm sorry, but so, I have to make a point of order.
No, you will be quiet because
this is what the chair should be doing.
You spoke,
I make
now
a point of order. They
you
should
spoke,
not be personal. It should not
you.
Be personal.
You're part of the bullying.
I have a point of order.
Shame on you.
I have
you
a point
out.
Of order.
You spoke,
I
now
will
I speak.
Not walk out.
You walk out.
We have verified evidence.
You're part of this.
This is a point of order.
You're part of this obsession.
No personal attack.
You're part of this obsession. You will allow me to finish my words.
Excuse me. Without personal attack.
You are part of this shameful behavior.
No.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's the image of Israel right now around the world. You just saw it right there. And there's more. Because not long after that, all the leaders of the Arab nations, they walked out at the United Nations and they held a joint news conference to beg the international community to finally put an end to Israel's brutality. What they call the attacks on Lebanon. It's occupation of the Palestinian territories. It's genocidal policies.
We cannot continue waiting as it relates to the question of Palestine until things to be sorted out in the region. The war in the Gulf region and also what's happening in Lebanon and the aggression against them. If we keep waiting, then this extreme Israeli government will sneak in under the smoke of the war and try, you know, to make decisive changes in the occupied Palestinian territory through annexation.
Sneaking under the smoke of war, huh? He's got them figured out. Then there's the European Union. There, too. This is an organization that consistently opposes Russia with sanctions, but seems to condone what Israel does. So one by one over the weekend, speaker after speaker, representing many different countries, stood up and looked at the leaders of the EU and said, you guys are hypocrites.
Mr. Sieper, I am shocked. You support sanctions on Russia, right? What else do I need to say? I mean, your hypocrisy, it's so, so horrible. So what are you actually saying? I don't mind that the Israelis bombed the Palestinians. I don't mind that they bombed the Lebanese. This is hypocrisy. Once it is about measures against Israel, it's like, oh, no, I'm going to look elsewhere. Yes, we can stop Israel if we stop funding it. 30% of their trade is with the European Union. Put the sanctions on that. Put them.
It is Israel and the United States who commit genocide and war crimes in Gaza, in Lebanon, in Iran.
More than 1 million people have been displaced. Hospitals have been destroyed. Children killed. Fighting terrorism certainly does not look like this.
What happens is the process of normalization of violence against Christians in the state of Israel.
By the way, China also got into the act. It attacked Israel directly in a surprising UN speech, calling what Israel is doing in Gaza, quote, open-air prison. From the Chinese, this. So here's China, arguably the fastest-growing economy in the world. Think about this. And they're joining forces at the UN with the words of the Vice President of the United States, all the Arab nations, the UN, and the critics of the EU, all of them coming together over a two-day period to condemn Israel. Never seen anything like this. It's a movement with a boldness and a directness that seems unprecedented.
We're deeply concerned by Israel's continued expansion of military occupation, the extension of the Yellow Line zone, and worse, its threats to control 70% of Gaza's territory. Israel's draconian restrictions are keeping over 2 million people in Gaza trapped in what amounts to an open-air prison. Minimum conditions for survival, such as sufficient food, clean drinking water, and stable shelter, remain luxuries out of the reach for Gazans. Humanitarian access must not be weaponized, and the arbitrary and reflexive closure of crossings only intensifies the collective punishment.
So what I wanted to do was give you a sense of how we got to where we are and what happened over the weekend, which I found kind of amazing, right? So that's pretty much the story and the reaction. Now, let's go to the reporting. Let's go on the ground. We're going to be joined now by RT correspondent Yassine Ekin. He's there in Lucerne, Switzerland. He's been following the story. I guess the first question is, what happened when both sides got together? Where are the meetings now? I heard the Iranians have left already. Is that the case?
That is correct. And on the surface, the United States looks calm and ready to drop bombs, forgetting that they signed a memorandum with their Iranian counterparts. The meeting did start on Sunday. It was scheduled for Friday, but the Iranians walked out when Israel continued to bomb Lebanon, which was a precursor and a very important clause in ensuring that the cessations come fold, essentially. And what we're seeing now is, of course, the delegations left on Sunday. The technical talks continued until Monday. And there are parts in which there is agreement, but the biggest clause is, again, it comes down to Lebanon. The first and foremost thing is to stop all physical attacks, but it's not just limited to that. There is a clause which also states that any threats made verbally are also off the table. The same way that they promised to keep the status quo, no new sanctions will be applied on Iran as long as the negotiations are ongoing. And let's not forget, the last two times or three times that Iran sat at a negotiating table, they were attacked by either the United States or Israel. So threats are a matter of concern, but looking at how things are unfolding, it also does paint a picture that it is possible that the United States is on the record, perhaps speaking to its constituents at home and off the record, based off of statements from Iran, suggests don't look at the headlines. There are people behind the scenes putting in the work. And moving forward, it is possible that they are gaining some ground.
Yeah, but how do we reconcile all of this? On the one hand, we have J.D. Vance, you just saw my reporting on that, blasting the Israelis and certainly their cabinet, although we know that Netanyahu's behind all of this, of course. On the other hand, we have the President of the United States saying he wants to blow up Iran. And then we have both sides meeting. I mean, this is like a kabuki theater or something. Pardon me for being confused, and pardon the rest of the world for being confused, right?
Yeah, you're not the only one that's confused. Everything about this is confusing, which is why I said that it is possible that on the record, they're trying to speak to a different audience. Where behind the scenes, they're trying to make some sort of, they're trying to move forward. But again, it comes down to whether or not the United States can convince the Israelis to come in fold. And based off of the agreement, they've told, well, essentially all of us time and time again, that they're not going to be, they're not going to abide by any agreements made by the United States or Iran. And they have their own issues that they need to worry about.
So just to be clear, here's basically where we are. Iran says it's not just about you attacking us. It's also about Israel attacking Lebanon. So if Israel continues to attack Lebanon, then we will take control of the Strait of Hormuz once again and close it or partially close it. And that's exactly what they have done. And that's kind of where we are right now, correct?
Yes, and let's not forget Iran's position as well. If Iran were to put Lebanon aside, leave them to their own fate, let Israel do whatever they want, then in theory, and even practically speaking, Iran does have a lot more to lose because the U.S. is essentially guaranteeing Iran access to trade its oil. It's essentially promising quid pro quo, in a sense, maybe, to ease sanctions.
Yeah.
So Iran has a lot to win, but Tehran's position is very simple. Like, I'm not going into this alone. Lebanon is on the table. Israel needs to get out. And this is more than just Israel, from what I'm understanding. This has to do with exactly what Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said. And he said, we have a foothold in Syria, in Lebanon, and in Gaza.
Yeah.
And he continues to say that he wants to do this across the region. So if Iran walks away with essentially a win-win-win, in the long run, it could, very hypothetically speaking and practically speaking, be a loss.
So what Iran is really saying then, Yassin, is a win for us is not good enough. We're here to fight for the region. We're here to fight for the people of this region, not just us. What good does it do us to have some kind of peace around our borders if everything outside of our borders is going to be in chaos as Israel continues to gobble up those countries and start wars in those countries? Did I characterize what one would think is their position well enough?
100%. And this is not just... This applies for Iran, yes, but it also applies to many of the regions, the countries across the board, that if, let's say, hypothetically speaking, Turkey was given, was in a similar situation and given the same out, that Turkey would not move forward because, well, naturally, that's a matter of concern. And again, it's more than that. Just based off of the statements from Tel Aviv, not just the prime minister, we're looking at ministers within government that are very openly calling for genocide, calling for regional domination. So Iran's position is to ensure not just that this stops, but essentially wants the United States to guarantee that it will never happen again. And that's the biggest contention point, isn't it? That Israel's very adamant in saying that it will not adhere to the requests of the United States, doesn't care about what their foreign policy is. They will pursue their own, which is, in a sense, disrespectful, particularly because they dragged the United States into this war, costing them billions of dollars, costing the global economy billions of dollars, and insulting, if anything else. And Iran understands this quite well.
And the people of the United States are angry about this and becoming more angry every day. And so are people in, you know, in Europe, for example. By the way, final question. Jared Kushner, was he there? And Witkoff, was he there? Did the United States actually send these two guys back to face the people they betrayed, lied to, and had their families assassinated? Seriously?
Honestly, I'm thinking about it now. There's really no good answer. Like I said, none of this makes sense. To a degree, I did say, for example, this could be an attempt from Washington administration to, again, speak to a different audience while it's trying to portray something else. But then you have stuff like this, and it just doesn't make sense because then it just means that you're either trying to be insulting or you genuinely don't understand the sensitivities or the dynamics of the region. So the United States is currently in a predicament where it's trying to move forward. And I think the only thing that is keeping this memorandum or this prospects of a long-lasting peace alive is the fact that Iran is working diligently. But more importantly, I guess, is, of course, we have mediators in the mix as well.
Yeah.
Qatar and Pakistan have issued a statement suggesting that they have a high-level committee. They will have oversight, politically speaking. Chief negotiators will, again, come back to them, yeah, and they will work forward. So they're building a roadmap. If not for that, it is very well possible that we could have seen either one of the two delegations walk off and not even discuss the prospects for another.
Yeah, but I mean, you get my point, right? The idea, the signal that is being set when the Iranians walk into that room and look at the face of Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff has to be, you guys again? You guys, you were the guys who betrayed us, yeah, who lied to us, who were talking to us, and then were talking to Bibi Netanyahu. You're the guys who had our spiritual leader killed and his family. What are you even doing here? The gall for you to even show up. I'm call me crazy, but I mean, somebody in the United States has to be thinking, do we really want to send these guys over there? And I guess, what does that say? I don't know. I know. It's not a question. It's more of a statement. And if you're looking at me like, Rick, I hear you. I hear you too, Yassine. Thank you so much. We certainly appreciate your reporting. But it is a good question. And it's one that probably needs to be asked, not by me, but by maybe people in the United States who are sending these guys. All right. Keir Starmer, who better than George Galloway to dissect the story we led the show with? Keir Starmer is out. It was a sudden resignation. Well, George Galloway has worked in the British Parliament. He knows the country inside and out. In fact, he was with me not long ago, and he basically predicted what just happened. And I got that video. We pulled it out. I'm going to play it for you, and I'm going to play it for him as well. But there's so much to talk about. This is such a juicy story about Starmer. It says so much. But what else will it say about the future for the UK? That's what we're going to ask. Stay right there. This is The Sanchez Effect. And we'll be right back. All right, so Starmer is out and Galloway is in. George Galloway is joining us now. So I promised folks that last time you were here, you said something which pretty much was predictive of what just happened. We've got that video, and I want to play it for you. Here it is. Take it, Gene.
Keir Starmer yesterday announced a new trade deal with North Korea. They were dancing in the streets of Pyongyang.
North Korea.
And then at the end of Prime Minister's questions, he had to correct himself in that nasal whine of his. Yeah. And it, of course, means South Korea, not North Korea. And then he...
Outright. This is your prime minister.
Yeah, at the moment.
Key word, at the moment. And here it is just what, I don't know when that was, 10 days, 2 weeks ago or something like that, and Keir Starmer is out. What was your take when you heard the news?
Call me Nostradamus. I danced on his political grave.
Did you?
He's the reason I'm in political exile. He has turned the United Kingdom into an authoritarian hellhole. He has changed the character of Britain all in 2 years, and all at the behest of, certainly on behalf of, foreign interests, Israel, Ukraine, the European Union. The people who are lamenting his passing today are exactly those. Zelensky tearfully regretted the departure. Ursula, fond of lying, did the same in Brussels.
Did you say fond of lying?
Fond of lying. And Netanyahu will be doing the same, although he's probably preoccupied at the minute, hasn't yet caught up. But the truth is, the British people are rejoicing. A nation rejoiced when they got this news. And as you say, it was to many people a surprise, but not to me, because I could see the tectonic plates shifting against this man. You cannot survive in democratic politics with an approval rating as low as his, because the members of parliament, who by and large care only about continuing to be members of parliament, can read the writing on the wall, and that writing says, join the unemployment queue at the next election. And he was leading them to disaster. So he had to go. Now, that doesn't mean the next fellow will be better. I happen to know the next fellow even better than I know Keir Starmer.
It's between two guys, or
no? It's at this moment only one. It'll be a coronation, and that is why I must say, if you'll permit me, this is a democratic outrage. A British Prime Minister is akin to an American president. Mm-hmm. Doesn't have quite the executive authority. There is a nominal monarch, sovereign above him, but it's only nominal. What the Prime Minister says goes. So we've now replaced a guy that was at least elected with a guy that nobody has elected, not even the Labour Party members, because it's looking like a coronation. It's looking like he'll be the only candidate in the race. So no one will have voted for him, but he will have all power in the state, power over our foreign policy, our attitude to the EU, to the Ukraine war, power over economic policy, power over everything. It's an executive. Prime Minister originates in the Latin primus inter pares, first amongst equals. But they're not equals anymore. The Prime Minister calls the shots. And we've got an unelected one coming up fast.
I heard his speech, and I was kind of disgusted by it.
Yeah.
You know, first of all, he wasn't talking to the people of the UK. No. He was reading every single word like it was written for him by a team of lawyers.
By AI.
Yeah. Didn't you get that? And I got a sense that everything he was saying was braggadocious and untrue.
Well, fundamentally untrue. I heard you ask that question earlier in your show. Is that true? Well, the answer is no. First of all, Britain has never been lower in public esteem, including in the esteem of our own people. We know that our country is on the road to nowhere, or worse, road to oblivion. Our country is falling apart economically, socially, culturally. Its international reputation is in the tank, as anyone who travels in the world already knows. And he was talking as if he had somehow restored Britain. In fact, most of us want the Britain we had before we ever set eyes on him.
Right.
And the truth is, he is the most, I would say, hated. It's a strong word, Rick.
Yeah.
But I would say he's the most hated prime minister we've ever had. We've had more divisive prime ministers, Margaret Thatcher, Tony Blair, but they were hated by a section of the population, however large. Keir Starmer is hated by everybody, left, right, and centre. And so nobody is crying about him going, except himself. He cried at the lantern, and he seemed to feel sorry for himself. It's a very unbecoming look.
Right.
You've just been forced out because you're a failure.
Right.
You've been forced out because nobody likes you.
Right.
Now you're crying in front of people been done some kind of injustice.
Every once in a while, it seems appropriate when a man, you know, we're told by our society that we're guys and we're not supposed to cry. But every once in a while, when something affects you, like, you know, you think of your dad, you think of your mom, you think of something that happened, I can see where I apologize. But when I watched him cry, he was crying because he was kind of sad that he'd lost a good gig.
Yeah, although he's going to be well looked after. He has £115,000, so best part of $150,000 for the rest of his life.
Wow.
He has a permanent 24-hour protection from the security services for the rest of his life. He gets an office in Parliament and an office wherever else he wants. I mean, he's well looked after. And, of course, he's already a very wealthy man.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So
the reasons for his self-pity were merely ego. It's bruising, to be sure, to win a 200-seat parliamentary majority. That's a record, by the way. That's the biggest ever majority.
That's how he won.
Now, he won it by default because he wasn't Rishi Sunak, because he wasn't the Conservatives. He won it by being a stoic block of wood that didn't give away anything that he was going to do. And everything he's done, he didn't tell us he was going to do. And it's been one nightmare after another. He took the old age pensioners' heating allowance. He introduced state-sponsored suicide in the country. We spent almost two whole parliamentary sessions on that one, turning Britain into one big pod where old people can be encouraged to go off and die. He has given away our money, lock, stock and barrel, to the thief of Kiev. And as you rightly pointed out, $3 billion a year for 100 years, imagine.
Can you imagine?
100 years. And
it takes intestinal fortitude to decide that my money is going to go someplace because you make the decision forever and ever.
Yeah, and he even name-checked this particular largesse in his resignation statement. Like there's anybody in Britain happy about it. We're not happy about giving money away to Zelensky. We're not happy about his role in the Gaza genocide, in which he backed Israel completely. Mm. He's a human rights lawyer, by the way, who said Israel has the right to withhold water, food, electricity from the Gaza Strip, when legally they absolutely do not have that right under any law, never mind any morality. So this guy has been A to Z, a complete failure. And worse than a failure, he's worsened our position, our economic situation. We can't afford to heat ourselves, can't afford to feed ourselves. Our children are going to school hungry. Our factories are closing. He's capped our oil wells in the name of net zero, green madness. I mean, you don't have enough time for me to tell you how many disasters he's presided over.
Where did these types of cads start running the British government? Has it always been like this? Mm. Or is it these institutionalists, these guys who are bankers and they associate only with weapons makers? And you can really tell both by their soul, by their morals, and by their attitude that they don't give a crap about the people that they're supposed to look
after.
He's
a creature of the swamp. He's a creature of the deep state. I met him, actually, on his rendezvous or his reconnoiter of Parliament just before he got elected and shook hands with him. It's the only time I ever have. I don't really know him. But he was then the director of public prosecutions, presiding over the injustice to Julian Assange, avoiding justice for the most notorious BBC paedophile, Jimmy Savile, and deciding not to prosecute him. Whole string of deep state preoccupations were his business. And he was undoubtedly put into Parliament in 2015 with a view to becoming one of the top Labour people.
Protector.
He had nothing that, I mean, he can't talk, he can't think, he can't write. He has no visible qualification for that job at all, not even service. He joined the Labour Party and became a parliamentary candidate on the same day. He had nothing in common with the party he then went on to lead. He betrayed the former leader, and now he's been betrayed. Karma's a bitch, isn't it?
What happens to all those people in, you know, the more I read about the UK, a country I love because my wife and I honeymoon there, so it's kind of personal for me. And, you know, one of the things I loved in college was Willie Shakespeare. Yep. Everything I could read, I gobbled up. So I love the country, but the more I read about the country now, the more I see that the people are totally disheartened and an existence has been forced upon them, in part because of these never-ending wars that they don't deserve. Can they rise up? Does the system allow for... I see it in my country. I see in the United States, thanks to Tucker and Candace and some other people, that the American people are saying, enough with this Israel crap, enough with these stupid wars. Is that happening in the UK?
Well, you have protections that we don't have. There's no Tucker in Britain. I'm the Tucker of Britain, and I had to leave the country.
Wow.
To broadcast from China, Indonesia, Vietnam, Russia, anywhere but Britain.
So did I under Biden, by the way.
Yeah.
So,
but
yeah.
You've got a constitution. We don't.
Yeah, that's true.
We are subject to the whim of a here today, gone tomorrow prime minister. And we are increasingly the least free people on the earth. There are more people jailed arrested for social media posts in Britain than any other country in the world.
That's crazy.
It's not China. It's not Russia.
Yeah.
It's Britain. 12,000 last year, and this year's figures are going to be even worse. And when I say arrested, I mean five armed cops at your door at 4 a.m. in the morning. Mm. This is Gestapo Britain. Yeah. That's what we've become. I was across 5 decades a British Member of Parliament. Trust me when I say I'm one of the best-known people in the country. And I was arrested by armed police officers in a London airport and under the Terrorism Act, accused of disinformation. Now, what they mean by disinformation is information they don't like, a point of view that they don't like. Now,
exactly,
that wouldn't happen in even most European countries, perhaps Germany being the exception. But it happens in Britain now, day and daily, even to somebody like me. And if it can happen to me, it can happen to anybody. So the chilling effect of that is very considerable. You don't want the cops at your door, you will not express yourself, even though you have, theoretically, the perfect right to. You censor yourself. As Francis Bacon said, self-censorship, the arrow that flies in the night.
Yes.
Nobody sees it, but you feel it. And that self-censorship is now abroad. Now, the new guy, I can tell you about him if you like.
Yeah. I hear he's a little more domestic-minded.
Although he's a member of the Labour Friends of Israel, which he joined for opportunistic reasons, because you had to. Some people are Freemasons because they can get on better in their profession that way. In Labour politics, you've got to be a member of the Labour Friends of Israel.
It's crazy.
He joined it in 2015, just prior to running for leader last time. He stated in that campaign that the first country that he would visit if elected was Israel. Now, I mean, that's just puerile, pathetic. But that's what he said. But more pertinently for you, he campaigned in 2018 to withdraw the World Cup from Russia, to forbid Russia from hosting the World Cup, everybody says was the best World Cup ever at that point. Maybe Qatar has overtaken that, but Qatar and Russia, the two most controversial picks, so-called, were the best World Cups we ever had. Andy Burnham did everything he could to get the World Cup taken away from Russia. Hmm. So these are not good signs. But the good news is there's no point in overthrowing the Prime Minister and then continuing all of his policies.
Exactly.
And all of his attitudes. If the whole game is to be victorious again at the next general election, then you're going to have to change something. So we'll put all our efforts into demanding a general election. We've already had a long string of unelected prime ministers, and each one has been worse than the last. Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, I could go on. These were unelected people, foisted on the British people as their leader, and it all went south. And we're about to get another one. So we demand a general election, and we're getting ready for one. Because who knows? Burnham might say, this is probably a good time, there's a bit of a bounce, I'll go. But secondly, if he's not going to call a general election, he has to change course. He has to get out of this Ukraine trench, which is bleeding us of our precious national finances, and is making World War III ever more likely.
Yeah,
we've got to get out of it. And we've got to get out of this infatuation with Israel. If Donald Trump and J.D. Vance
can do this,
can turn against Israel, Andy Burnham, the Prime Minister of Britain, can.
It was funny. I was listening to his speech, and one of the things that stuck out, and I can't quote exactly what he said, but something to the effect of, I am the Prime Minister who went after and stopped anti-Semitism. And I thought, okay, yeah, that's good. You should. Anti-Semitism is bad, but so is anti-Catholicism. Yeah. So is anti-race. So is there's a million things that you could have said, and I would have respected if he would have said anti-Semitism and this and that, but he didn't. No. He stopped after one thing, which told me that is all you care about?
That was a job application. That was a message.
Yes.
To people who can look after him even better in the
Say what you're saying. Say what you're saying.
The new guy, Burnham, is a Roman Catholic.
Yeah.
He will be the first Roman Catholic Prime Minister of Great Britain. Tony Blair became a Catholic after he left office. That's how deep-rooted anti-Roman Catholicism is in the British state.
Really?
A member of the royal family cannot marry one, and no British Prime Minister until this one coming up has actually been brought up as
a Catholic like me
Roman
is not
Catholic.
Allowed to marry into the royal family. No?
Oh, no.
Not just because I'm Hispanic and dark.
They hanged our nuns, our priests. They burned us at the stake. They have never lost their anti-Catholic bias in Britain.
Wow.
Because of the balls of Henry VIII.
Yeah.
Henry VIII was refused a divorce because of his adulterous behavior, going through one wife after another, cutting their heads off.
Yeah, yeah, great story, great book. But do you tie that into Israel now? How does that relate to Israel?
Well, it doesn't really. But what I meant about Israel was that this was Keir Starmer indicating to the masters of the universe that he's available for hire. He did his job for them during the Gaza emergency. He's singling out his extirpation of anti-Semitism.
Yes.
What's causing anti-Semitism is the behavior of Israel.
Yes.
Insofar as there has been an increase in anti-Semitism, a scourge which led to the Holocaust, don't get me at all wrong, anti-Semitism is a foul poison.
Of course.
But what is causing anti-Semitism is Benjamin Netanyahu claiming he's acting in the name of Judaism, when in fact he's acting in the name of ethno-supremacist nationalism, Israeli nationalism. And so this was a job application, and he very carefully asked the AI that wrote that speech to make sure that all these boxes were ticked.
Yeah, looking.
He was able to cry about his own children, but he never shed a tear about the hundreds of thousands of Palestinian children that were slaughtered
so well
in a genocide that he supported.
Yeah.
He couldn't muster a word, never mind a tear, about the children who died in the school buses in Donetsk, the Belarusian kids.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't shed a tear or say a word about the children that died at Starobolensk that you visited, who were murdered in their sleep in their dormitory. If you can't cry for other people's children, then you're no man at all.
You're evil.
Yeah.
You're evil.
You're no man at all.
You're not godly. We have something in our country, in the United States, that we call the Uniparty. In other words, it doesn't matter whether we elect a president who's a Republican or a president who's a Democrat. In the end, we're going to get the same crap. Is that the case in Britain as well? Does it matter?
Sure. Two cheeks of the same ass. I'm the author of that phrase, and that's exactly what we have in Britain.
Well said, by the way.
The only thing is that the Conservatives are now so small and emaciated that the real action is inside the Labour Party.
Really?
And what we've done now is exchange an identical ass cheek, one for the other. And unless there's a change, Labour is headed for the door. So that's why I haven't given up hope.
Will it make a difference, though? If the Conservatives get in there, are they like, I like J.D. Vance's positions sometimes. There's a lot of people in the Republican Party in the United States who I think are a little closer to the truth, not that they've found it, than a lot of people in the Democratic Party. Not that I pick one party over another. Mm. Is that kind of, you think that's a possibility in England?
I think what's needed is a break with this uniparty, this so-called two-party tradition. And that's why I hope that our friend Tucker Carlson will run as an independent.
Yeah.
Tulsi Gabbard, in my opinion, would be the best running mate. I think
Candace, too, you know? I mean, imagine.
You spoke to her. You know her better.
But she said she told me, Rick, I won't run, but I'll back Tucker and work with him.
See, Tucker seems to me such a standout.
Yeah.
He's Kennedy-esque. He has the looks. He has the gift of the gab.
Yeah.
He has the deep knowledge. He has the huge contacts. He's even got a father that was in the CIA, for God's sake. So his...
And he's morally well-adjusted.
He is.
I mean, I know that's a weird way of putting it, but I have adjusted...
It's weird nowadays. Once upon a time, it wasn't weird. Right. Once upon a time, it was...
We're supposed to be.
You're supposed to be morally well-adjusted.
Yeah.
We've just
or your dad would kick your ass.
Yeah. Yeah. We've had a succession of people for who'd say, moral? What is moral?
Right.
So our standards have lowered. But he is, Tucker Carlson is a highly moral person. But he's also a worldly person. Yeah. He knows the world ain't perfect, that you've got to take account of that, make adjustments for that. The world will be a much safer place with President Tucker Carlson. And if they're worried about his perceived waywardness, well, put Tulsi Gabbard in there. She's a creature of the security state, the director of national intelligence, a serving military officer. There you go. That's a dream team. You can thank me later.
When I first talked to Tucker for a long time and we were hanging out, I remember he loves the UK because he's from there or feels like his heritage is from there.
Yeah.
And he hates it for what it's become as much as anyone.
Yeah.
Disrespects its media entities, disrespects its institutions, really thinks it's gone way in the wrong direction. He told me that before I realized that. You know,
he came to London, Rick, to interview me, except I'd had to leave London in the interim. So he had to interview me from London in parts overseas because of what happened to me and my good wife and the fact that we were just waiting for the knock on the door, the midnight or 4 a.m. knock on the door.
Yeah.
We were just waiting for our studio to be closed down.
Think about how the UK has turned, in many ways, I said this the other days, into the things we didn't like about the USSR. In the USSR, you weren't allowed to get information from the outside. In the UK today, you're not allowed to get information from the outside. In the USSR, they would have KGB people knock on your door and ask you what you were thinking, what you were reading, or what you were doing. That's happening today in the UK.
Sure.
In the USSR, they didn't allow you to tell your children how they could think or what they should read or what they can do. They just passed a law in the UK saying anybody under 16 is not allowed to be on the internet. We decide what you... And they take down your phone number and your information.
And they're going
what
to
does
force,
that sound like?
They're going to force Netflix to show BBC output so that they can control it. They're going to jail Elon Musk, if they can, at this current rate, Elon Musk will not be able to come to Europe because he'll be arrested if he does.
Meanwhile,
they did arrest Pavel Durov.
But you and I are in a country right now.
Yeah.
We're here. We're here in Moscow, and I don't see those things here.
Well,
I'm allowed to read. I read the BBC here. I read CNN here. CNN is here interviewing Putin. The BBC has a correspondent here. He's about 4 foot tall. But, you know, I mean, they're here, but these people are not allowed to be there.
Look, this is the era of cross-dressing. Now, dissidents come from the West to the East so that they can be free to speak.
Yeah.
The opposite of what it used to be. We are doing this interview. Nobody even asked you, never mind told you, what you were going to say. And nobody even asked me, never mind told me, what I was going to say.
But I do have some really cool doodles here.
Yes, exactly. We are freewheeling here.
Yeah.
I freewheel all day when I'm in China, when I'm in Russia. I say exactly what I want. You don't have to agree with it. But what somebody asked me today.
Including criticism of Putin, including criticism of Xi, saying there's people in this country who want him to do this, there's people who don't want him to do that.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, it is what it is.
Somebody asked me today, why are you saying Starmer was the worst prime minister ever? Have you forgotten Margaret Thatcher? I said, Margaret Thatcher hated me, but she never tried to stop me speaking.
Yes.
She never set the police on me with guns to arrest me. In an airport, in public. She never did, pardon me, any of those things.
Yeah.
And so that's why I say Starmer is worse. He has instituted a reign of intellectual terror where you are told in the most Orwellian ways you're not allowed to say that a woman can't have a P penis. Sorry to introduce that, but it's a big issue in Britain. It's illegal to say it. If I'm confronted by
say that again. You're not allowed to say that a woman cannot have a penis.
You're not allowed to say that. It's illegal.
Because that's discriminatory.
That's you're misgendering, and you are encouraging hate. I am confronted by a 250-pound gorilla wearing a wig, and if I call him he rather than she, I've committed a criminal offence.
No.
If I try to stop him going
That's in the statutes?
Yeah. If I try to stop him going into a lady's lavatory, it's me that will be arrested, not him. So Orwell was right. It was a manual that he wrote, 1984.
Yes.
It's now coming to reality right in front of our eyes. War is peace, truth is lies. That man is a woman, and so on. Scotland, where I come from, even talking like this in my house is a criminal offence. Can you believe that? If we had a dinner party and I said to you what I've just said on television and somebody at the dinner party reported it to the police, I'd be under arrest.
Just like it was in the old totalitarian days in places like the USSR, where if you told your children something, they went to school and repeated it, then they would knock on your door and say, did you teach your children this? Same thing.
From my point of view, at least you got socialism in return.
Yeah.
You had to put up with all kinds of bad things, but you got some good things in return. We have got all the bad things and none of the good things.
Great point.
The European Union has become the EUSSR. It has all of the disadvantages of the USSR and none of the advantages. And it's presided over by people with even less democratic credentials...
That's the point.
...than any ruler of the USSR ever had. Who elected Fond of Lying? Who elected Callas? Who elected any of these...
Oligarchs. Ruta. Another guy. Who's that guy?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I don't even know who they are. Sometimes I can't pronounce their name. But they are deciding the political direction of 350 million people. And look at the decisions they're making. All their decisions go wrong. They've now had 21 packages of sanctions against Russia. And just this day, I have lost track of the Maybachs going past the restaurant where I was dining on the pavement in the sunshine with everyone in their finery going by.
Exactly.
I lost track of them because I like Maybachs. I'll never own one, but I like them.
It's like a Rolls Royce. It's a car. Yeah.
I say to my wife, Maybach, Maybach, Maybach. You won't see a Maybach in London. You won't see anyone in their finery. You won't see anyone dining in a pavement cafe, and you will not see the kind of prosperity that now exists in Moscow. Sanctions? Take that, Putin. We threw these boomerangs, and they've all come back and hit us. They didn't hurt Russia at
all. No.
They just damaged us.
Right. Better lifestyle.
These unelected decision makers are making self-harming, suicidal decisions, and no one can remove them.
And they're supposed to be the true democracies. I doubt that's true. George Orwell would be very proud of you today, George Galloway. You've represented yourself
Thank you so much.
What a pleasure it is to talk. Thanks for coming in. I knew this was the perfect topic for you.
Yeah.
And this, we thought of you right away.
I'm off to China now to get some freedom of speech. Forgive me.
First thing I did when I went to China, I think I told you this story before. I asked the driver, what do you think of Xi? He said, he sucks. I can't stand him. He's one of those princelets. We don't like him. And I thought, well, this is great. Just like any other country. You arrive and the taxi driver is telling you he doesn't like the leader or the president, which is, you know what, the way it should be. He should have a right to say those things. Even though I tended to disagree after seeing the way the Chinese system works. Well, that's it for us. We're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us. And, you know, as I always like to say, now that we've garnered so many tens of millions of people who are following us in so many different ways, thank you so much. Whether you're on X or on Spotify or on YouTube or on BitChute, it doesn't matter. And most of all, as I always like to say, thank you so much for letting us into your homes. I'm Rick Sanchez. This is The Sanchez Effect, and we'll look for you next time.